Accession number 20267, Reel 5.
John Webber, Reel 5.
Edward Sturges, who was always up to some tricks or another, decided that on our way in, before we landed, he would dive bomb the commando on parade with toilet paper, which we duly did, which created quite a mess. We had never heard officially, but I think he got a bit of a wigging from the CO about it afterwards. And then the other incident, while we were there, we got up early one morning, we got in the back of the 300-weight trucks and were driven out to do a live ammunition flamethrower landing exercise on a pillbox, training exercise. But before I relate that, perhaps I better relate the other incident. The night before that, we'd been in the sergeant's mess, and there'd been a consignment of drinks come into Trincomalee from South Africa, which included sherry brandy, creme de menthe, and other liqueurs. And we'd been in the sergeant's mess that night, and we'd had a drink. We weren't on a binge, we were just sat there quietly talking, but sipping liqueurs. And then I remember when I got up to walk down the mess to go back to my quarters, that the wall and the chairs kept jumping out on me. And when I laid down, everything went round and round in bed. And then I dropped off to sleep. The next thing I remember is the next morning, waking up with a horrible head, with the Cockney sergeant of the guard leaning over me and said, "Come on, Webber, you're on the exercise." And I remember getting up very vaguely and staggered out to the section. I've forgotten the forage cap comforter, much to the amusement of the section. Anyway, we got in this truck and we went on to do this exercise. And as I say, we drove out in these trucks. They backed them up to what was an imaginary beach, and you had to leap out of the trucks and run up this beach, which was in fact a sort of a beach, and do this exercise. Well, I landed, and that run, it was about a 300-yard run up this imaginary beach. My head and heart was pounding like anything. But when I threw myself down, my head cleared, just like that. It was clear as a bell. I can remember all the detailed instructions about the exercise, and we went through it. But what I also remember about it, when it was the first time I threw myself down, or subsequently, that this marine, who was always a headache with me, managed to bayonet my trousers through into the sands by missing my leg. He threw himself down. He somehow stuck his bayonet through my trousers into my leg. We went on and did the exercise and went back to camp for breakfast. And of course, I get back there with a head as clear as a bell. There's all the other sergeants walking around, the worse for wear, shall I say. And that was that. So that's the main things I remember about Trincomalee. I knew there was some fun and games went on in the officers' mess when Captain Lieutenant Royder got married. But we didn't witness it, but I believe they tarred and feathered him and threw him in the sea. And then where did we go? We went back.
But were you going to tell me about this pillbox?
Well, no, we attacked this American, you know, we did this exercise with the flamethrowers and the live ammunition. We completed that exercise when our head was clear what we had to do. The way it was over, we got in the trucks and went back to camp. And then when the other ones were feeling the worse for wear. We subsequently went from Trincomalee, went back across and up to Madras, where the main thing I can react there is paying coolies to race back to camp and giving more money to the winner. And then we sailed up to the Arakan and eventually arrived at Technaf again. And it was at Technaf, after some demonstrations and very reluctantly, we lost a much loved and respected CO, Colonel Horton. He was drafted back to England, and there was a huge protest from the commando about his going, and they left him there for a little while to calm things down, and then he eventually left us. But he was a much loved CO and badly missed, actually. We then went over for a spell of, what is it, at Mong Do. We were, the line was up the front, but I remember that we, a couple of three occasions, driving a jeep up along the coastal end of the foothills to supply the troops up on the forward lines. But we used to drive the jeeps, and occasionally got a shell lobbed at us, but nothing else. And that was when, of course, when Five Commando were doing it, they got involved in quite a scrap. And then we came back and prepared for the invasion of Akihab Island. And we had Christmas before that, Christmas dinners. I remember we remember using the armour sergeant's blowtorch to burn the stubble and feathers off the chicken they provided us for Christmas dinner. The rum punch, which was pretty potent stuff. And also, in the hut, I remember the mess tables. I remember putting a cloth along the front, round the front of it, to make the front of it. And making, I got some wood, and there were some white and blue flowers there. And I remember making a little floral cross, which we fastened onto the front of the sheeting, which formed the altar for the communion service we had on Christmas Day. Sort of an impromptu church. There was the table was the altar with this cloth, with this cross of blue and white flowers, and the padre took the communion for those that wanted to go from there. And then going down to Yakiab, it was a most motley looking array of landing craft that you could imagine to see. And we went on down and we landed. Of course, unknown to us at the time, the powers that be knew the Japs had deserted Akihab, but we didn't know. And apparently, General Crittison watched it from the ship. Of course, there was the naval, the Sheffield, and the cruisers out for the bombardment. But we landed by this big bunker, and we, I remember, spent the night there somewhere. I remember we had to fill up our water bottles, and we had to put, I remember putting tablets in to purify it. And then we moved in and took up sort of residence in Akihab itself, onto the harbour at Akihab. I can remember the upturned hull of one of the Royal Indian Navy's sloops. Forget which one it was now, Rusty. I can remember HMS Sheffield coming into the harbour and anchoring up in the corner. I can remember a Jap Zeros coming over, and I can remember the ACAC all opening up, particularly from the Sheffield. Then subsequently, rather humorously afterwards, not the same day, I think a day or so afterwards, a Dakota came in to land on the airfields. And what's all the Indian anti-aircraft gunners were opened up on this Dakota. And I can still remember the red very lights flying out of this Dakota. Which, you know, then the firing at it stopped and it landed. Well, we learned afterwards that one of the senior officers of the anti-aircraft unit was on board that, so somebody must have got the right telling off afterwards. But it was to see this coming in and then firing at one of our own was a bit... And the other thing was, did I was one of a small party. We had to go down. There's a lighthouse on a little island at the entrance to Akiab Harbour. And we had to go down and make sure that that was clear. And I remember landing on the beach and we going up. And when we went, there was no one on board there. But when we got onto the into the lighthouse, just inside of the door, you could see where they had fixed up a machine gun on fixed lines, which would have covered the whole of that area of beach of which we would have landed. You could see the marks in the tower. We searched the lighthouse and had a good look and came back. That was it. And then the next thing was, of course, after a while, we went down to do the landing at Maibond. And again, we were the reserve commando. We were the last commando to land. Well, I remember it was late-ish afternoon when we got off this beach. And again, something had gone wrong somewhere, but they put us ashore on the wrong beach. They put us ashore on a receding tide on a mangrove swamped beach. And we stepped out of the boat up into mangrovey mud and water up to our midriff and struggled ashore. And of course the longer it went on, the worse it got because the tide went further out. I can't remember now, I've got it down somewhere. It took us 2 or 3 hours to get ashore. And of course when we got ashore, we were not all fit to do anything. We were covered in mud, the weapons were all full of mangrove mud. In fact, five commando who landed on it in front of us, one of their men I know said that, well, we thought it was bad enough, but the commando coming behind it had it a lot worse. And they, when we got near the shore, some of them would come out with ropes so that we could get hold of them to pull ourselves ashore a bit. Anyway, we got ashore, covered in mud. And I remember that there was a shell hole, a bomb crater, full of water. And I can remember taking off all my clothes, getting in this shell hole, washing all the mud off of myself, washing all the mud off the clothes, spread it out in the sun, and wait for half an hour or so, or 20 minutes, whatever it took, for it to dry, put it back on again, then sit down and start cleaning the weapons so that they were serviceable. And we were really sitting ducks for quite a while. Of course, the ironic thing is we should have been put on the better beach the other side. Anyway, by nightfall, well, that's an unforgettable experience. It was frightening, it really was, because you didn't think you were going to make it. You were stuck in the mud and that was it. It was really, really very frightening.
Did anybody open fire?
No, because the other commandos had landed. They pushed them back. So, you know, we were safe in that respect. If they had been still had positions near the beach. What did happen? To our right, where the Chong went up, on that beach, that side, the Japs were firing mortars from there, which were landing in the mangrove swamp. But, of course, they just went in and didn't explode. And it was a strange thing. After I was relating this incident in the canteen at the police station one night, and one of the other sergeants there said, well, it's a good job you're telling the truth, Johnny, because he said, I was on a boat, I forget what sort of boat, in that chong, and I can remember seeing it happen. It was a strange coincidence that he should know what I was saying was correct. We finished up that night in some old Japanese defensive positions, where we found a lot of solidified methylated spirit burners, so we were able to put them down out of sight and brew up some tea, an hour of tea, and we spent the night on guard, I remember, because I'd cleaned our weapons, and I can remember at least we had a bandolier of 303 ammunition out on the parapet, and a piece of 4x2 out of our rifle and some oil, and in the sort of semi-light, you take a clip of ammunition, take the bullets out, put them down, clean the clip, then clean each bullet till you clean the five, then clip them back in, put the completed lot back in, the clean lot back in the bandolier, take the next lot out and so on. And I spent the night doing that, and with Lieutenant Ryder next to me, and it was intervals of tea brewed up, and we stayed. And by that means, we got ourselves back into sort of fighting fit, or fighting trim anyway. The next day, we moved off and did an attack on a hill. We were on the right flank. That was just beyond my bomb village. And I can remember seeing several Japanese soldiers fleeing up the hill in front of us. And further to our left was the bunker where the tank rolled backwards trying to attack it, but it was too far to our left actually for us to see it. But I know that's what happened. And then we got, after that, there were various operational moves. We got brought back into the middle, sort of in reserve again. And I also remember what was floated around there then was some, what's the best way to describe it? It was small sheets of paper of what you would call pornographic Japanese literature. And there was a few pages of it which sort of got passed around those on site. Other than it was pornographic, I can't remember much more detail about it. Then we got moved up again, right up to the river which ran across, River Kantha, I think it was called. And the Indian Brigade was in front of us, which consisted of one Gurkha battalion. And when we were in reserve that night, the Japs counterattacked. And there wasn't much firing, but during that early hours of morning, there were the most blood-curdling yells came from up there. And when we moved up the next day to take over, there was bits of arms and bits of body lying about, where the Gurkhas had waited till the Japs got amongst them and set about them with their cookies. And they moved on over the river, which was tidal. And we moved up to the river to, that was as far as we were meant to go, because the 51st, I think it was, Indian Brigade was sent to go on, or one of the brigades. And whilst we were there, we were sort of, the road was there, and we were sort of racked behind there. And a couple of us at the front, and this lorry came up, 15 underweight, with a Gurkha driver and that, and some other men. So he said, "Oh, tea, Sab," he said. And we said, "Oh, Johnny, tea?" "Yes, Sab, please." So we said, "Right, round the back." So we went round the back, thinking we just got the one Gurkha laddie for tea. We finished up with about half a dozen of them somewhere. But they were that type. They were very friendly and fought a lot of the green berries, and there was a this comradeship between them and us there and then. And then they went on. And then we got called back. Well, we were moved back down near the beaches again. I remember that we had our little small mosquito nets to put up to sleep under, and we had a day or 2 days there before we prepared for Kangol. And we didn't really have much idea what was to happen in detail at Kangol, but we got on board. We were taking out what boats we went on, but anyway, we eventually got into some narrow boats to go up the Chong, which is like going up a river, and you were sat facing one another, and there was like a section of us in there. And it was I think the whole journey was 25 miles from Moy Bon to Kangol, but the river bit was about 17 miles up this river between the Chong and the bank, so you just went on and on and up. And it was a long journey. And I always remember I was sat opposite Corporal Fleming. And eventually we landed on the beach. Well, you can call it the beach. It was just like mangrove swamp and that. And we landed and moved up behind the back of Hill 170, which was the hill at Kangol with the famous battle took place later, which had already been taken by the army commandos and other units. We came up in reserve behind there. And then the next day, I think it was, or later that evening, we moved up to take the next hill because, you know, we were on a plain below a lot of hills and we were taking each one in turn. This one was, we took the next one, which was called Milford. And then we were ordered to take the next one again, which was Pinner, which was the furthermost one into the Japanese foothills. And nearest the road which we were to cut, because there was a road, well, they called it a road, it was more like a footpath, came down the valley, went on down or cut through the hills in towards central Burma. So it was a very strategic point. And either side of that junction, as it were, there was two big hills that side and the hills we were on this side. The idea was, of course, was to cut the Japs off there. So we moved up onto Pinner that, I suppose, in the early morning, and we started to dig in. Or it might have been late morning, but we started to dig in on the hill. I remember, not from us, but it was a bit difficult, because when you got down very far, you hit rock, not soil. Anyway, there's every reference that what happened afterwards was our own fault. But we were told to stop digging and have a rest because we were to move on to another hill that night. And the next hill was called Duns, which was right in the village of Kangol. And we had sent out a patrol to reconnoitre the route to that afternoon. So, you know, so we stopped digging in anymore. Well, probably finished off what we wanted. And we were resting. Waiting, you know, tonight. We stood too. And it was there's a very good description in there of it, somebody wrote. Though it describes it accurately, but it doesn't describe the atmosphere, the feeling that, you know, it was. No, like some people say, things were right in on you. You know, you were really, you sort of, I don't know what to say, you had a feeling, but you didn't know what was going to happen, sort of thing. You know? You sat there waiting, beautiful moonlight night, and all of a sudden, about 8 o'clock, they started. They had an equivalent to a 25-pounder gun in the hill opposite us. And they started shelling us. Now, no sooner had we heard the explosion from the firing before the shell exploded in amongst us or went through the top of us. And, of course, it was tree-covered, very heavily tree-covered, and they just plastered us with this bombardment. Because it was tearing through the trees, some were exploding amongst us, some were tearing through the trees, shredding the trees into sharp bits of wood and splinters and coming down on us. Of course, we had no protection up here.
On your back.
On your backs. And then, of course, they put in their frontal attacks with their mortars and their machine guns, and you could hear them in the jungle in front of you, and they kept trying to take the hills. Right in front of me, I could hear them, and I never saw one where we were. But if you read the account, the other end they did, one section was virtually completely wiped out, except Sergeant Aymer, who's since died, and he was badly wounded. Because of all this coming down, there was Corporal Fleming, who sat opposite me. He was killed, very close to me. ACAC Marshall, another of my corporals, I remember he got injured. I remember lifting him out of his slit trench and taking him down the back of the hill, and getting hold of his shoulders was like catching hold of pulp, because he'd been hit by all this wood stuff. And he kept on shouting, "Come on, number one section, at him." And which was bad, really, because it was pinpointing our position. But he subsequently died in the night. Fleming was killed. Tony Bolland was cleared. You know, they were all members of my section, quite close to me. Nothing miraculously came near me, but we waited there all that night. They kept on. Then they had another go with the bombing and the mortaring, and it was a very long night. And there was quite a lot of. I think it was about. I think it's in there. I think it's 86 or more casualties amongst us that night. But we. They, and then of course, I don't think they, back at base, because Brigadier Hardy came up the first thing the next morning, but they were half surprised to find that we had still held on to the hill, because if we'd have lost it, it would have very much jeopardized Hill 170, which was subsequently heavily attacked.
What hill were you on?
We were on Pinner, it was called. It was the forward one of the lot then. We waited there, and then later in the day we were relieved by units of the Hybridad Regiment, and we withdrew back behind Hill 170. And then we were put on the defences of the beach, the side perimeter, so that we couldn't be flanked. As it were, we were on the. Can't remember which one. We were on the. At least the section I was with was on the side chong, not the main chong. One was called Thames, and the other was called something else. And we were on, you know, duty there. And also the thing I clearly recollect is that when we were there, we were. Moving back down, I think, from Milford or Pinner or from 170 back to the beach. Probably back from 170 to the beach. I was walking back down. I heard this shell coming. And I threw myself flat on the ground. And it exploded shortly behind me. And this huge piece of shrapnel.